CataractCoach.com, podcast number 34 with Dr. Larry Burstein, ophthalmic wisdom that young surgeons must learn. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast, and today I'm with my dear friend, Dr. Larry Burstein. And we're going to talk about his journey in ophthalmology, the past 40 years, and what lessons have we learned along the way. But I want to start this podcast with something a little different, something I haven't done before, and that is by asking a question, a riddle. For all our listeners, primarily those in their 30s and 40s, maybe even their 50s, the riddle is, what was called a ticking time bomb in the eye? What was that that many years ago, ophthalmologists, especially academic ophthalmologists, said, don't ever do that, that would be a ticking time bomb in the eye. Larry, what's the answer?
Intraocular lens implants,
believe it or not. An IOL?
An IOL. Frowned upon all the, in the past, introducing what was considered a foreign body, a foreign object in the eye. It's now obviously the standard of care. And years ago when we first started, intracaps, had to push to develop into extracaps, had to learn phaco all on my own as I've already been in practice. And IOLs were frowned upon way in the beginning. Articles were written, how dangerous, how can we do this? You know, glasses, you know, can you imagine aphakic spectacles today?
Plus 10 glasses,
plus 10, 12. Plus 12s. And now the standard of care intraocular lens implants, IOLs, originally viewed
as a ticking time bomb.
A ticking time bomb in the eye. Complications, what are we going to do? You're putting a foreign body in the eye. Always taught against it by the most, it was understandably, I don't want to use the word conservative, but it was, like anything else, it's the struggle to adapt to advancing technology.
Right.
And my original attendings and professors and residency director was like, whoa, what do you mean? You're gonna put a foreign object deliberately into the eye? We don't know the future. We don't know what's gonna happen. What's gonna be the long term? There was no long term.
It's crazy to think, but there at the time, putting an IOL on the eye was considered like, wow, taboo. Because as you said, they called it a foreign object in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's interesting. There's always been that resistance in change. People don't want to change.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also been, on the other side, a push to keep innovating. I mean, today I can't imagine even doing a cataract surgery and leaving a patient, or all our patients, aphakic.
Mm-hmm.
It makes almost no sense.
Absolutely. Everything being spectacle independent.
Right.
Can you imagine being doomed for the rest of your life with plus 10s or plus 12 spectacles?
And, wow.
Yeah. And getting rid of appliances. We are blessed with the technology today.
Sure.
Even from, obviously, we've advanced from standard lenses, still needing reading glasses, whatever your target is, or distance
glasses. To newer
technology
lenses.
Newer technology to be free of appliances, free of glasses, glasses free.
Yeah.
And think about it. Back in the day, it was like viewed upon and frowned upon. Like, what are you doing? We don't have any long, how could you have a long-term study
on
something brand new?
I think the bottom line for it is, that our field keeps evolving.
Mm-hmm.
The way you learn surgery in your training, whether you're training 40 years ago, 20 years ago, or even 1 year ago, the way you learn to operate is not the way you're going to operate 20 or 30 years from now. There's no way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's a constant evolution of the way we do things. You know, I was had an interesting point you brought up earlier when you were learning. You learned phaco on your own. Like, you did your entire residency having done zero phacos.
Mm-hmm. Not allowed. When phaco machines were first coming out, for all of us, we actually went and to develop our learning curve and taught ourselves manual extra caps as a pathway to learning phaco ultimately.
So intracaps, then manual extra caps, and then ultimately phaco. Learn phaco.
Yeah.
But then how do you do it? You're in practice. You've done your residency. You're board certified. You're in practice. Now it's time to learn phaco. And you have to learn with your private practice patients.
Yeah, it's challenging. It can give you some anxiety, but you know, good preparation, like anything else, taking advantage of the teachers who knew and the technology. Not as easy as today. We couldn't pull out your phone. You couldn't pull out YouTube. You couldn't pull out Cataract Coach and see what to do and be trained by watching and learning. We had to do it the old-fashioned way. The old-fashioned way.
I mean, we're so spoiled now. Anywhere on the planet, you can use this mobile phone and watch a high-definition edited video of any surgical procedure. It's how I learned DMEC. DMECC corneal transplantation, I learned it by watching videos.
Yeah.
And then you do it and you hone your technique. There were videos back in the day. In fact, we saw some of your old tapes from maybe more than 30 years ago.
More than 30 years ago. The Video Journal of Ophthalmology.
Oh, well, Dr. Osher.
Bobby Osher.
The godfather.
The godfather of ophthalmology. I had some videos of Dick Lindstrom, another godfather of ophthalmology.
Sure.
Blessed to have even that tape. Taking those tapes, sticking them in a VCR.
For our young viewers, you may not know what a VCR is or these tapes are. These are plastic boxes with magnetic tape that had low definition video on them.
Yeah, and we were blessed that Bobby brought that to us and Dick and everybody else at the time signed up for a subscription Video Journal of Ophthalmology, a different video each week or each month. I don't even remember now how frequently they were, but what a beautiful collection, and a VCR, video cassette recorder.
Yeah,
so
that's
old
wild.
School. And the definition, I mean, now we're looking at all your great stuff on Cataract Coach, high definition, anything you want, just look it up.
In an instant. From anywhere on the planet.
Anywhere.
That's the wildest part. So you've obviously lived the whole journey. Let's kind of rewind. Let's go back. Tell me about your path in ophthalmology. How'd you decide to go to medical school? How'd you decide ophthalmology?
Well, I was very blessed and very fortunate. You know, my dad was an optometrist.
Okay.
So I had a little inkling and a little idea about that. He always wanted to go back to school. He went back to medical school at age 40.
Wow, so that's not easy.
He could become an ophthalmologist. And he ended up finding a different passion. Still begins with an O. He went into obstetrics. And I always teach.
So he's delivering babies instead of delivering cataracts.
Delivering cataracts, right? And I figured he's working his way down. Soon he's going to be an orthopedist doing foot surgery. He's just working his way down the body. So I initially was fortunate to have that desire with ophthalmology. And then I didn't know what to do. I wanted to do it all.
Right.
And in ophthalmology, we're blessed. You have old patients. You have family members. You have their kids. You do medical work. You do surgical work.
Yeah.
You have a spectrum of everything.
Right.
So,
you also started on this path very early, because you went straight from high school to that combined bachelor MD program. Tell me about that.
BA MD. I was fortunate to get accepted and go to the Boston University 6-year at that time. 6-year.
I think now it's 7,
program.
Right?
It's now 7. Some of the programs have been gone to 8. But that 6-year medical program, what a blessing.
Right.
Because I knew as a high school kid, 17 years old, I was accepted into medical school. My buddies were struggling and trying to go to college and restricted to try to take all the pre-med courses and be so competitive and make sure they could make the cut and get into medical school. A lot of them had to go abroad to medical school training. And what a gift. I was always grateful that I had the opportunity as a kid to know that I had medical school acceptance when I was 17, 18 years old starting.
Yeah, that's a fantastic program. It's so ultra competitive these days. It's unbelievably competitive.
I'm grateful I had that opportunity.
Yeah, and then tell me about your residency training.
So I did my residency training at Albert Einstein College of Medicine.
The Bronx.
The Bronx.
Awesome.
Yeah, the Bronx, New York. The combined, the hospitals were the hospital of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, Montefiore Hospital and Medical Center, Jacoby, where we had tons of trauma. Forget one ruptured globe a week or a month. We had several ruptured globes a night.
Wow, so, you worked hard. That's the best way. When you're young and you're training, best way to learn is by doing.
Learn by doing. Learn
so you worked hard. That must have been an amazing residency program.
And anything worth doing is a lot of work.
Anything worth doing is a lot of work.
You got to apply yourself and study hard and work hard. And we've all been there. We've all done it, you know.
It's those ruptured globe cases, I tell you, in the middle of the night.
Oh, man. And trying to get the attending to come in and help and middle of the night. I once had a guy talk about, I'll tell this really briefly. A gentleman was fishing up in the Bronx, New York, fishing, was retracting his fishing rod to cast, and he hooked himself in the eye with one of those triple lures.
Oh, my goodness. The fish hook in the eye.
The fish hook in the eye.
You know what? I think we all end up seeing that once or twice in residency.
Yeah.
So how'd you fix that case?
Oh,
that's a tough one.
The key to that case, there was no way to get the reverse barb. We had no instrumentation to do it. I had his wife bring the tackle box up to the operating room where we autoclaved his device that is used. I don't remember the name of
like
it.
Some
wire
cutters,
cutter, some wire cutter thing, and we sterilized it.
Wow.
Wire cut the, and he actually did pretty well. He ended up 20/40 or so.
Wow,
corneal
amazing.
Scar,
amazing.
A peripheral corneal scar, got the fish hook out of his eye, and everybody was going crazy about, what are you doing? You want to autoclave that? And that was the only way to get the hook out of his eye without causing more trauma.
I never even thought of that. We had a case like that when I was attending a residence, and so we ended up doing was the the oral maxillofacial guys on their tray. But when they wire up jaws, they had some wire cutters.
So neat.
We took theirs.
I hope you gave them back.
We just borrowed them. We just borrowed them.
All right.
But no, those are the way you learn in the middle of the night when it's like, I mean, the kind of pressure's on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you give the patients your best there. So tell me about your path then. You finished your training there in the Bronx.
I finished.
At Einstein. So Montefiore and Jacoby, two busy hospitals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I did a straight med, after completing the 6-year program.
You're right.
I did a straight medical internship.
Why is that? You didn't do a rotating one? Or
You know what? I wanted to learn how to be a really good doctor first. I wanted to have the comprehensive internal medicine decision-making thought process. It was the first year of what would have been a 3-year internal medicine rotation. I did straight medical. There's nothing wrong with any of the other options, rotating a bit of this and a bit of that.
Whatever floats your boat.
Yep, whatever works.
Well, now it's combined. So now, I did a separate internship and then a 3-year ophthalmology residency. Today, it's all together in 4 years, where the first year is 9 months of not ophthalmology and then 3 months of ophthalmology. So you get 9 months of it.
That's nice. The transition at the tail end of those 3 months to kind of
pave the way. Yeah, sometimes it's mixed in the middle too. Okay. But a lot of people don't realize that in the days before, it was very common to do residencies. People did med school, a 1-year internship, and then you practice as a general practitioner.
Oh, boy.
Remember those?
I remember those.
Yeah.
I remember those days.
So just to do ophthalmology, you have to first do the full training to be a general practitioner, then do the ophthalmology subspecialty training.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a lot of debate back then. You know, New York Eye and Ear, Manhattan Eye and Ear, all the Eye and Ear hospitals, and people were asking me, why are you doing a straight medical internship? Why don't you just, you know, go to an eye center, an eye hospital? And again, nothing wrong with that. That's a great way to go. But I really wanted to get...
Be a good doctor first.
Be a good doctor first, and then apply that and that thought process to ophthalmology and ophthalmic surgery.
Oh, I mean, it makes a ton of sense. So you finish your training, and then how do you go into practice? What do you decide to do? Because obviously the times were different then. You had different options.
Yeah, and you know, there weren't these big groups then. There wasn't private equity then. There weren't. But one of the things, the challenge, and you can get intimidated to just start your own practice as a kid and have the revenues to do it. I couldn't rub two nickels together.
Right.
So it was pretty common back in the day to join with somebody, which I did. I did that. It lasted about 1.5 years. It was a good way. I thought of it at the time as like a fellowship in private practice.
Right.
How am I going to run a business? How am I going to set up shop?
Right.
And I expected it to be my career choice. Unfortunately, it didn't work out very well. And as scary as it was, and as challenging as it was, I decided I was going to do my own thing and set up my own private practice.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of the lone wolf syndrome in ophthalmology because sometimes when we're young and we finish our training and we go to join a group, sometimes we can get lucky and it'd be an amazing fit and you're there for life.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you don't feel like it's the right fit. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you feel like maybe you're taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the reason why there's so many lone wolves in our field. It's happened to me. I often joke with the residents, like, your first job, maybe like your first girlfriend or boyfriend. Fantastic, but may not be the one you're with forever.
Yeah, that's a very good metaphor. That's a really good example. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. But you know what? Very blessed. Land on your feet. Whatever, you know, when you have the skill set and it's hard to be confident when you're young and starting, but you have to step up. Have that internal drive and ambition and confidence to just, you know what? I got to do what's going to work best for me because that's what's going to be best for my patients. If I can be at my best, that's what the highest priority is. The only priority is to be the best you can. It's a privilege and an honor to take care of patients. And I couldn't afford to be distracted with the tension and anxiety and the difficulty of the partnership I had. And it was like, I got to focus on the quality of care. I can't focus on the aggravation. And I wanted to be a good doctor and not be held back in any way to be able to make the best choices on my own, do things the right way, do the right thing for the right reason, have it be up to me.
Right. I mean, if you're a great doctor, you will succeed. There's just no question.
Absolutely.
It may take some time, but if you're a great doctor, you're going
to
do well.
And it does take time and effort. You know, I used to cover all the other established guys, cover their night call. I signed up and did the emergency room call. Back in the day, you'd get called to go into the emergency room. And then those patients, my purpose was to be of service to the patients. And I wasn't trying to take or steal.
Of course.
But those patients would gravitate to you.
It wasn't for
the secondary. Again, I did it to do the right thing.
Right.
But you end up getting a nucleus of patients. And all of a sudden, everybody's signing out to me. And they overflow. And I just, little by little, just built the practice.
And so you stayed in your own private practice for a long time. And how did it change over the years?
Well, we're blessed in ophthalmology with all the technology, how sure. it changes, and industry and all the disruptive technologies. Sure. But what changed for me the most was after I did my private practice for 35 years or so, and then with the onset of group practices and private equity, it was time for me to just be the doctor, have all that administrative work be taken away. I didn't want to be bogged down with
put it on someone else's shoulders.
Yeah, exactly. And the trade was, they'll do the management, they'll worry about the hiring and firing, they'll do all the administrative stuff, and I can just go to work, see my patients, do my surgery, and just be doctor.
And there's an advantage there. Huh? There's an advantage of just focusing on what you enjoy. Mm-hmm. Then you get to another advantage, you get to work with fresh new blood, fresh new doctors.
Not just the fresh new ones, but even the more senior ones.
Right.
To learn techniques, be able to learn from the older gentlemen, not older, but you know, more older than I was
sure.
at the time, and learn from, and then get re-energized and have the young kids that come in, and you know, it's like the student teaching teaching the teacher. You know?
Right. Well, you've got a fantastic young doctor who joined you, right?
Oh, I'm
very blessed. Eric is an amazing guy.
A big shout out to Eric. He is a blessing. He is so well liked, so skilled, and his trajectory in his practice, he's like a rising star, and is actually officially a rising star in ophthalmology.
Yeah, we got to get him on the podcast for sure.
He sure will.
It'll be fun to talk to him. He has, especially with his engineering background, I like the way that he thinks.
Oh, he thinks beautifully.
Yeah. He ended up
teaching me tricks. His bedside manner is terrific. His skill set is unbelievable. And that helps you get re-energized and rejuvenate.
Right.
Not that you don't always have that desire to just be there for your patients, but a different way, a different perspective, and to see that energy again, and to get so enthusiastic.
Sure.
We're so blessed. Ophthalmology is so easy to love.
It's fun.
Yeah, and the passion for it, it just drives you. And patients are so grateful. Think about it. Patients walk in to see you. They can't see. Day after surgery, all of a sudden they can see. It's a whole new world. The gift of sight to give, be able to give to somebody is an amazing, it's just so gratifying and so fulfilling.
Oh, absolutely. I'm like you. Every day I'm thankful to be an ophthalmologist.
Absolutely.
Every day.
And we're thankful to have you.
You know, another part too is, we all learn together.
We learn together.
And it's nice to be, I guess that is one thing that's missing in a smaller group is, you know, if you're just a solo doctor, you may not have as much interaction with colleagues.
Especially when you first go into practice, because you're used to being in the residency program, used to
right.
being in the clinic, call over the chief resident, what do you think of this, what do you think of that? Now you're on your own, and you're making your diagnoses,
right.
and you're having to decide things for yourself, and you don't have cataract coach to look up what do you do with this, and what do you do with that?
So let's give an example. So if you're in the clinic, and you're seeing a patient, and you have to... You're there alone. There's no other doctors with you, let's say. Let's see, in a situation where you're just a solo doc or solo that day, and you see a patient with something challenging. You look at the cornea. It looks a little funny. How do you learn to trust your instincts? Like,
I went by an expression that, you know what? So you have to have your confidence. You have to trust your instincts. And you have to sometimes hedge your bet as follows. It occurred to me, when you have a straightforward examination, everything is straightforward,
right.
okay. When all of a sudden there's some question mark, you trust your judgment, trust your instinct, and I guided myself with this expression, that if I'm sitting at the slit lamp and imaging something, and if something even crosses my mind, if the clinical presentation makes me think about it, if it's that much significant that you're even gonna think about it, even if it's just on the differential, but not what they have, for example, you see the corneal, early corneal pathology. You're not quite sure. Gosh, is that a dendrite? Is that HSK? And you know what? I would say, you know what? I see so many corneas all day long. It doesn't even occur to me. If it's significant enough to occur to me, I'm going to treat them.
Right.
Because what's the downside? If it is HSK, herpes simplex keratitis. If it is HSK and I don't treat them,
that's worse.
Go from back
couple days later, terrible.
And if I was wrong.
There's no downside.
No downside. Put them on Valtrex. And what's the downside if you put them on it, if they don't need it? But if you don't put them on it, and the patient does require that treatment, you're already behind the eight ball.
So it's kind of trusting your gut instinct.
Trust your instinct.
Trusting your internal judgment. Now that all must apply to the operating room too, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. You have a small pupil case, and you know, you got to control your ego. It's like, oh, I can do this. I can go through that pupil. But if you're already identifying the fact that it may be a struggle, put in the iris hooks, put in your Malyugan ring,
right.
Make your life easier. The few minutes it'll take you to do that, or in your case, the 30 seconds it'll take you to do that.
It's worth it.
It's worth it. You make your life easier, doing a safer procedure for the patient. And again, trust your instinct. It's like, you know what? Am I going to struggle with this case, you know, or am I going to make it better for the patient and easier for me? It's a win-win combination. Do what's best for the patient and make your life easier and get the better the best outcome.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things we all struggle with when you're in training. Learning to trust your surgical judgment, or develop a surgical judgment. And then, you know, some of the instincts you have to avoid is kind of talking yourself out of something. Oh, should I put in iris hooks? Nah, I'll be okay. Well, just like you said, because you thought it, you probably should just do it.
Don't be a hero.
Right.
Don't be a hero. Just get the best outcome. And, you know, back in the day, right. I'm old enough, back in the day we had assistants. We had an assistant. So you could always... You know, you could always ask the assistant, like, you know what do you think? Is this pupil what we're going to do? But now you're solo. You're flying solo. You're a lone wolf,
right.
Like you said. So you have to have that conversation with yourself and make that decision-making, that thought process.
Another tough one is that the unfortunate but real instinct that we all have, which is sometimes denial.
Oh, absolutely.
You're doing surgery. You just don't want there to be a problem. So when there is a problem, sometimes we deny it. How do you deal with that?
Oh, you have to, again, you have to do the right thing for the right reason, overcome the now. You get a small capsule of rent. You get a rent in the posterior capsule. It's like, nah, I don't know. Maybe it's not. Oh, the vitreous is well behaved. But you have to just realize, get in front of things. Stay ahead of them.
Right.
Do not wait for the eye to tell you what's going on. You figure out what's going on with that eye. And we have all our tips and pearls that we look at, and you hear the snap or something happens, and
right.
you see the break in the capsule. And, you know, use all the technology. Use all your skills. Trust yourself. Trust your instincts. Rely on your education, experience, training, and your mentor. And that's another thing. It was tough to find a mentor back in the day.
Well, how do you find a mentor?
I found you.
we all find each other. We all learn from each other.
But... And you're the mentor for us. Nationally and internationally, people go, I still go on cataract coach the night before surgery as my preparation for whatever cases I have.
Well, I do the same. I go online. I'll watch surgeries ahead of time. Again, like I said earlier, it's how I learned DMAC.
Exactly. Or I'll bug you and call you up on the phone. Uday, I had a refractive surprise.
Right.
What do you do? Now I got to do the second eye.
How do you do the calcs?
And it would be, you know, the symmetry. So, okay, this eye has kind of the same calcs. I ran that case by you. This eye has the same counts as the other eye. I had a myopic surprise. Thank God it was a myopic surprise.
Right.
Because at least the patient can enjoy their near vision. And it was like, you know what? So don't target plano. You know, target plus two. I'm like, what? I'm going to target plus two? And you trust your training. You trust your mentor.
Yeah.
I targeted plus two. The lady came out plano, happy. And no multifocal lens. A standard lens with a minus two. And a standard lens with plano or maybe minus a quarter, happy as a clam.
Yeah, for
happy
sure.
Happy as a clam.
And yeah, it's funny how we all come back to that. Like, even though we have amazing technologies now that have changed the way we treat patients, trifocal lens, extended the focus lens, we still kind of go back to monovision sometimes.
Monovision. Monovision is has a role. All of these things have a role. Monovision. And I have people who's like, oh, I heard about halos and night vision and all that. It's like, okay, I don't want you to be unhappy,
right?
You know, and we can do it this way.
Just tailor the surgery to the patient.
You customize, you have that chair time. You know, we're always so much in a rush. It's really important. I'll tell you another one. If I have a moderate myope, moderate myope, and, you know, we're trying to calculate, you know, and to have a conversation. It's like, look, this is how you came from the manufacturer. They don't want to wear glasses anymore. I said, listen, I'll target ametropia for you. But then you're going to need reading glasses. What? Reading glasses?
Take it from a lifelong minus two, and you want to make them plano with a monofocal lens?
Right.
Be careful.
Be careful. Don't do it. Just say, this is how you came from the manufacturer. You're wired this way. You know, you can.
That's what your brain likes.
That's what your brain likes. That's what you like. And I'm not going to take away, you know, have that patient come in. What happened, Dr. B? I could always read without glasses. You took care of my cataract. Now I can't read without glasses.
What
did you do to me? So it's important to have that conversation and see what their needs are, meet their needs, do your best, spend that extra chair time to customize your treatment and understand what the patient wants. Make them happy.
No, I think ultimately that's probably the best pearl right there is tailor to the patient, make them happy. whatever it takes. But yeah, I agree with you. I'm a low myope. I like being a low myope.
Yeah. And I explained it to them, like, look, you were happy with your vision before the cataract developed? Yeah. You didn't mind wearing your distance glasses to drive and drive at night and things like that? Yeah. And now your cataract's in the way? Yes. Okay, so we'll solve the problem. And sometimes you don't want to change the refraction for exactly
right.
the reason we just
yeah,
discussed.
Of course.
We'll give you back to where you were. We'll take you back to where you always were and were always happy. Just get rid of the cataract and the visual impairment created by the cataract. But change you up from not needing reading glasses
right.
to needing reading glasses.
Yeah, I'd always say for residents, when you look at the lens calc sheet and it says the optimal power for emmetropia is like 17, 17 and a half, 18, 18 and a half. Be careful. That patient's a low myope.
Yeah, low myope, yeah.
So,
meanwhile, back at the ranch, as you know, the happiest patients are those low hyperopes.
Oh, yeah.
Low hyperope, a low to moderate hyperope, and that's a different story. Then you've really exceeded their expectation when you do that kind of work. But it's important to have the conversation, understand what the patient wants. I've spent so much time counseling patients accordingly. Patients who decline for whatever reason,
right.
a multifocal, for example, and they come back in the post-op and say, Dr. B, I made a mistake. You know, I should have gone with the multifocal. I don't like wearing glasses. Mm. And I'm annoyed that I should have chosen the multifocal. But meet their needs. Do what's best for them. Have a conversation.
Sure.
Counsel them accordingly. Do what's appropriate. You know, do the right thing for the right reason. But it's predicate. We get busy, running behind schedule. Don't be in a rush. They're
yeah.
going to have whatever vision you give them.
Forever.
Forever. For the rest of your life. They're going to have that vision for the rest of their life. I mean, obviously, unless you have lens and shit, whatever. But if basically, you could choose for them what they're going to
yeah.
how they're going to see for the rest of their life. So you make a cautious, careful decision and have that conversation.
Yeah. For our younger audience members, you heard something. He said low hyperopes. Why? Because in this, I didn't realize until I was already in practice, not a patient who's a higher hyperope, like a +4 for distance, +6.5 for reading. And made the patient emmetropic. I thought the patient would be so happy. And the patient says, thanks, but everything looks a little smaller now.
Mm-hmm.
Because the patient was used to the side effect of those +6 reading glasses
mm-hmm.
that it magnifies things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when they're, emmetropic for distance, and then they were +2 readers, it doesn't give the same magnification.
Exactly.
The image size is smaller.
Yeah, and that's important because you know what? If you tell them before the surgery,
right.
it's not your fault. If you tell them after the surgery, it's your fault.
Right.
You're to blame. If you don't match them up and customize their treatment and don't have that conversation, then what you did for them is your fault. If you
yeah.
have a conversation, they choose what they want. Where do you want to see? Do you want to see close? Do you want to see far? You know, what kind of lifestyle do you want? You know, we all use the terminology lifestyle lenses. Which lifestyle? It's not for you. It's for them.
Their lifestyle.
And if you change their lifestyle without having that
right.
conversation, that's your fault. You change it because you don't want anybody to make a mistake, but if they chose the wrong path, the lady I mentioned who declined a multifocal and now regrets it and so forth, the person who was bugging me to make them emmetropic, I just want to be like all my friends. I want to see for distance and I'll use glasses for reading. Okay, we do it and we hit our target. And they come back up and it's like, I don't know what I was thinking. I'm not happy this way.
Yeah.
I never had to reach for my reading glasses. You know, I never had to reach for my reading glasses. So decide where they want. You know, or you have somebody who just sits around and reads all day and isn't that active, doesn't drive at night. You know, so whatever makes the best fit. It doesn't take that long. And the patients trust you. You've got a patient for life. You've got their family for life. It's not about that secondary gain, but it comes back to you.
Of course.
Word of
mouth,
happy patient. One happy patient, you get a dozens. One unhappy patient, it can kill your practice.
That's true. Very true.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. Even though we've progressed all this way now, social media, and obviously I do a lot of social media,
mm-hmm.
and promotions and advertising, and the end of the day, my number one source of patients.
Other patients.
Word of mouth. You're
yeah,
right.
Word of mouth. Important.
And so that hasn't changed in 50 years, right?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And the other thing I did, which was unusual back in my day, but I would embrace it. And now we get along better with our optometric colleagues.
Sure.
But for the young people who may be watching this, send them a letter. They send you a patient, treat them like a colleague.
Right.
Send them a letter back. Thank you for referring so-and-so. We did so-and-so and so forth. So many. And again, you're doing it to do the right thing.
Of course.
But when you do the right thing, it has a magical way of coming back to you.
For sure.
And the optometric referrals, the networking from other patients, and you get, and I remember back in the day, my optometrist colleagues, they would call me and say, Larry, nobody ever sent me a letter. Nobody, oh, really? I've been sending out my patients. Nobody sent me. And don't steal their patients. Yeah. Don't fit them for, you know, just send them back. Yeah. Do what you have to do medically and surgically, and you send them back. You do the right thing. It comes.
It all pays off.
It all pays off.
Yeah. So what were the big challenges for you across your career of many decades? Things changed a lot. The way you, technology has obviously changed a lot. Surgical techniques changed a lot. Yeah. The way you do surgery changes a lot. So what were the big things for you and all those changes? What were the challenges?
Well, there's a lot there. Behind that one little question, there's a
lot. I mean, like, for example, in the OR, we talked briefly about, well, the challenge of learning FACO when you're already in practice on your private patients.
Yeah.
Why, how do you make that step?
Yeah.
What do you say to Mrs. Jones or Mr. Smith, like, hey, I'm going to try something new. I've never done this before.
Yeah, no,
what do you say?
No. You know what? You trust. You know what? I always felt that if you have a good foundation, your microsurgical skills, your foundation, trust your instinct, trust your judgment.
Right.
You just reapply the same skill set for a different technique.
Right.
And as long as you have confidence in being able to do that, then you'll find your way and it'll all work out. So pay attention to every detail, control everything you can control. There can be surgical misadventures and things can surprise you with an eye in the middle of the case. You have to be prepared for that.
Sure.
And you have to be prepared to do that. But there's some things that you can, that those things are not under your control. The things that are under your control, set up the scope, pay attention, lay the patient
right.
flat. Have the eye. You can't, there's no surprise if you position the patient right. There's no surprise if you have the scope set correctly. And you don't have to wipe out surprises. You can get some surprises intraoperatively. Those you can't get ahead of. But give yourself the advantage of having everything right.
Preparation.
Good preparation is the key to the best outcomes. Good preparation is the key.
I mean, we see this in practice now. I'd say most surgeons get to the surgery center early, get situated, set up the scope, get their chair the way they want it, make sure they're happy. And then there are a small handful who are, for whatever reason, always showing up to the surgery center 15 minutes late.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they're kind of rushed and like,
sorry.
You know, I just, for me, it's just like, wow, I couldn't imagine that kind of stress.
Yeah, and the other, so that's exactly right. Do whatever you can to minimize your stress.
Right.
I go into the pre-op area, I'm checking everybody's pupil. And then
I do the same thing.
I'm checking, and in my back pocket, I have all the dilation.
Right, I get the 10% fentanyl from my pocket.
I got that in my pocket. I have a little Cyclogel in my pocket, a little strong. So it's like, Doc, what are you doing? We've got this. We got the Flogo. I said, I just want to make sure.
Oh, we do it the same way.
You know, I'll even throw it. And so, you know, I believe this is, I like using atropine in a pre-op and a Flomax patient.
Sure.
There's been stiffen up the
good,
iris.
Good studies about it. Yeah. May not give you much more dilation, but you're right. It stiffens.
The billowing. It doesn't dilate them more, but it does make it a little bit easier. Stiffens the pupil a little bit more. And so if I didn't pre-order it, which is unusual, but we're all human. Sure. You can all make mistakes. Recognize you can all make mistakes. A bottle of atropine in my pocket. Now, I like to give it to them for 3 days, 4 times a day pre-op. But if I come in and say, oh, my gosh, they didn't pick up the atropine.
Yeah.
Oh, Dr. B, I did this drop, that's the other thing. Make sure they were compliant. Make sure they took their pre-op antibiotic drops. And I'll say, oh, I started giving them the atropine. Those patients, as part of their kit pre-op, just give it to them. Use it.
Well, it's what I've done now in practice. I no longer prescribe the post-op drops. I pay for personally. I get compounded.
Oh, excellent.
Bromfenac.
I do the same thing.
Prednisolone, moxifloxacin. Compounded. And I just get the bottle and I give it to the patient. There you go. No pharmacy needed.
And the compliance is so much better.
Right.
Not this one 4 times a day. This one twice a day. Just mix it all up. Take this one bottle. Which bottle did I do? Which? I would give them pre-op sheets and instructions.
No, we all did. That was the way it was done before.
Yeah.
Before we got much more popular with the compounding, that's exactly how it was always done.
Compounding makes their life easier, makes your life easier.
Everyone's. Yeah. Whoever said, let's push this compounding thing. Brilliant. Thank you. You've made our lives a lot easier.
It definitely did. And the patients, like, most important, everything should be geared for. It's a privilege and it's an honor.
Yeah.
I don't want to sound goofy, but it really is true.
And
it's really what I believe. It's a privilege to take care of patients. We all talk about this difficult patient, that difficult patient. You know what? These are people, they're trusting you with us. And as a matter of fact, day to day in my practice, whether they're coming for an office visit or their surgery, I say thank you for trusting me with your eyes.
It's your most precious sense.
Exactly, the most precious sense you have. Now, the dermatologists say skin is the most important organ, but seriously,
of course.
But how many, and people tell me that, you know, your hearing, I mean, as difficult as that would be to go without, but you can't see.
Right.
Oh,
so,
my goodness.
Game changer.
It's the most precious.
No, I think it's why we all gravitate towards ophthalmology. We just see how an amazing field it is, but also how thankful the patients are.
Yeah, and that gratitude is something, and getting notes and letting, I mean, it's just a grateful, happy patient. There's nothing that makes me happier than a happy patient.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and for talking to patients, too, about a new procedure, I'll tell them, well, you know, we can do your cataract surgery this way, the way we've always done it, and I can do that for you, but I think there's a new technology that can actually give you a better outcome. And if it's okay with you, I'd like to use this new technology, and if it doesn't pan out to be a great thing for you, we can still go back to the traditional way.
Right.
And then patients understand. As long as the patients know you really care.
And how many times after you give that explanation to say, Dr. Devgan, do what you think is best for me.
Yeah, always.
Just do what you think is best for me.
Right, always.
Yeah. You know, you can do this, we can do that, I can make you this, I can do that. Say, Dr. B, just do what you think is best.
Well, I think that's another important point, is that patients are seeing you for your expertise. And so the patient says to you, okay, doc, I'm here for my cataract surgery. If you give them like a laundry list of options, they don't know which one to choose.
Mm-hmm.
But if you say, okay, let's talk about this. Let me see what you answer on your questionnaire. Let's look at your eye anatomy. And then you give them a concrete recommendation saying, you know, based on your eyes,
mm-hmm.
your anatomy, your measurements, your needs for your vision, your desires, this lens is going to be the best option mm-hmm. for you.
And it works on the flip side. If you don't hit your target, if there's something going on, you have some kind of unexpected outcome,
mm-hmm.
you don't walk in. You walk in ahead of it and you say, listen, before they even say a word, you know they're sitting in there. Your
right.
text says, I have an unhappy patient. She's post-op. She's not happy. You walk and say, listen, I wouldn't be happy if you start. I see what you have here. I see all the results. You know what? This is how you healed. This is what happened. We can fix this. But all of a sudden, that hostility they may have or that disappointment they may have, if you get ahead of that and you
right.
start the conversation
right.
saying, Mrs. Jones, I'm not happy with this. You know, I'm not happy because you know already that they're not happy. If you come in saying, listen, we've got this situation. This is what happened. You know, sometimes the numbers betray us, and sometimes we have to go back and make an
right,
adjustment.
Right, right.
And all of a sudden, they trust you again. They're not mad at you anymore. It's like, oh my God, I didn't even tell Dr. B that I don't like this and I'm not happy with that. He came in and he said, look, I don't like what we got here. This is not what I intended.
Because I know you're on their team. You're going to help
team.
Them.
It's not adversarial anymore. You're on their team together.
Right. Like sometimes a patient will, you know, you have this rare refractive miss and you do all the lens calcs. You look at six different formulas. All the formulas agree this patient needs a 25 diopter lens. And you do the surgery and the patient ends up a little bit myopic. And then now it looks like, well, a 24 may have been a better choice. The patient says, well, why'd you put the wrong lens in my eye? In fact, you didn't.
No, you didn't. Exactly.
Everything agreed. You put the correct lens in. It's just the patient's healing response
mm-hmm.
is different
right.
than we expect. In the bell curve, the patient's not in the middle of the bell curve. They're one of the outliers.
And they don't understand ELP and effective lens.
Yeah, you can't explain that to them.
So you just have to explain it to them. And they can't comprehend that, but
right.
you just have to have a truthful, open and honest conversation with them. You know.
Yeah.
And it's also, you know, they're not going to understand this part either. I don't know about you. I would think it would be the same. But if you're going to be off on the minus side.
Right.
When you're doing your calcs and it's a little bit borderline and you don't have exactly the right, what you would want to have, pick the one that's the first minus.
Yeah.
So you can go back and use the laser. And
a little PRK, a little
the
LASIK. Or even sometimes, like in this lady, what I ended up doing was where she ended up a little myopic. I think she ended up at minus 75 or minus
mm-hmm.
one in an eye, where we were aiming more for plano.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we do is then, well, I took the way the first eye healed to help hone the calcs in the second
mm-hmm.
eye,
mm-hmm.
and then did the second eye, hit plano,
mm-hmm.
and now she had a beautiful degree of monitoring.
Exactly.
Plano in one eye, minus from the other, it turned out to be a blessing.
Exactly.
As long as she understood, like, this is the way you heal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, literally for the second eye, when the calcs called for 25, I said, no, we're going to put in a lower power lens
mm-hmm.
because I know how
mm-hmm.
you're going to heal.
Just like you guided me on that case I
right,
told you, the hyperopic
right.
patient who ended up a minus two. I said, that's okay. We're going to go into, we're going to do the other
right.
eye. And it takes some courage. You have to have that trust. And it's like, look, the eye, the numbers are similar. The actual
right.
length is similar. The K's are similar. You got an unexpected refractor surprise
right.
minus two. So talk at plus two. You know, and just treat it that way. Learn from the first eye. And that's another reason why I know that we're trying to do bilateral same-day surgery
right.
and so on. I like doing the eyes a week or two apart.
You
I like
know,
seeing
yeah,
what the refractive
sure.
outcome is on the first eye so we can make adjustments on the second eye.
No, I think that's super important. You've got to be able to, like, see what the outcome is, especially for patients who are not average. Mm-hmm. If you're not an average patient, yeah, it's important to be able to check that out. Patients where the calcs come out pretty close to 20 Doppler lengths, like the patient has been emmetropic their whole life,
yeah,
calcs are pretty accurate.
You know that.
When you get to the high end, and yeah, like the high hyperopes, whoosh. You know, you get eye power near 30, a fraction of a millimeter movement of that lens.
That's it.
Big change in the refractive outcome.
Yeah. And the reverse is true. I'm sure everybody knows who's tuning in, you know, about the high myopic, you know, adjustment, right, the Li Wang, you know, formula.
Right.
To make sure you do all those steps and...
of course, yeah.
And adjust the power based on what we know to anticipate. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been fun stuff. So that's a big challenge. Big change is obviously in the OR because techniques kept evolving, new technologies. What about in the stuff we don't talk about too often, which is like, you were there from the beginning days of Medicare where you actually got paid very reasonably to do a cataract.
Very reasonably. Do you want me to say numbers?
You could teach us, because a lot of the young people, we don't even know.
You know, back in the day, I started in 1982, 83, 84, and in 1984 dollars, $3,600 an eye. For a cataract.
In $1984.
$1984, $3,600. Yeah. And now what is it, $5,600?
$500 for $2023.
$2023, 90-day post-op care.
You know, it's a different world.
Yeah, it's a different world. But you know what, it's not about the money.
Yeah.
You can't be motivated by money. Your motivation is always to, you know, that's what you took your oath for. That's why you went to medical school, to help people. And yeah, as a side effect of doing your best, that is how we happen to make our living, but that's not the priority.
Of course.
The side effect of what we do is our ability to be able to still provide the best care, pay our expenses, be able to do what we do, but you do what's best for the patient. And again, it's hearing myself say this today, $3,600, $1984 compared to $600, $2,023.
Or less.
Or less.
Yeah, I know it's wild. But then again, if we really, really wanted to be all about making fantastic income, we would have become hedge fund guys and Wall Street bank investment bankers, exactly. And we wouldn't have done medical school and all that.
No, it has to be a passion.
There's a sacrifice you take. One, you're also very fortunate that you were able to go from age 17 out of high school and 6 years later already become an MD. Whereas the path now is most of the people who do medicine do 4 years of undergrad for a bachelor's. Mm-hmm. Very common now to take at least one gap year, if not two or three gap years, do a master's degree. Mm-hmm. Then apply to medical school. Mm-hmm. And then you do your 4 years of ophthalmology, and then people are now doing a 1 or 2 year fellowship on top of that. So you can be like early to mid 30s before you're out of it. And let alone the people who do a combined MD PhD, mm-hmm, or people who do, you know, ultra specialized, like two fellowships. A lot of people are now doing, let's say, you'll do a uveitis year and then surgical retina, mm-hmm, or mm-hmm, you know, something, or a melanoma year, mm-hmm, and then 2 years of surgical retina. So it's a long road we do.
Yeah. Not to interrupt, but you know what? It reminds me of a really good point. You mentioned retina. If you're struggling, if you're looking, if you think there might be a tear, someone has flashing, rely on your colleagues. Send that patient out.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I know you give talks and you talk about share the liability.
Share the love and the liability with retina people.
So don't hesitate. And even if, you know, and if you're doubting anything, yeah, most of the time you do your indirect, you do your gun or your scalpel exam.
Sure.
And you know, but if you're ever not sure, send them to the retina doctor. It protects them. It protects you.
Those important lessons. Yeah, trust your gut instincts. And when in doubt, have a colleague help you.
Exactly.
Whether you're getting advice on the phone, whether you're showing to your colleague who's down the hallway in the same clinic, mm-hmm, or whether you're sending it to another colleague across town.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, it's like, I'm pretty sure there's nothing here. I don't want to have to make them, you know, go and see another doctor and so on and so forth. They thank you for it. And there's something else just popped in my head.
Tell me.
It's not off subject. All of my 40 years of practicing, I only had to cancel my operating room day once in my career for having the flu.
Wow.
And there was a part of me like, no, I can do this. No, I can get through it. No, I can't disappoint them. I'm going to kill my practice. I'm going to lose these patients. They're never going to come back. They've gone through everything. They've made transportation arrangements. They've seen their medical doctor for medical clearance. And I'm going to cancel their surgery. You know what? You owe it to them to be at your best. All those patients that I had canceled that day, they respected me more for it.
They want your A game.
They want your A game. Do not bring anything less than your A game.
Right,
and
that's
important. Guided myself by many, many rules, like, you know, the mental preparation, get your rest, you know, all the things you do the night before surgery, get to bed early, you know, be prepared, you know, no carousing.
I think we're the same way. I mean, you've got your night before surgery kind of routine.
Yeah, exactly.
I like getting solid sleep. If I get a nice solid 7-8 hours sleep, I just do better surgery.
Whatever it takes to be at your best. You're right. Not going to be up all night. You're not going to be up late.
Right.
You're not going to, you know, be hungover or anything.
Whatever,
just be
yeah.
at your best. I've left dinner meetings. You know, we're also fortunate to have, you know, networking and dinner meetings and things like that. And it's like, guys, it's my night before surgery. I'm going to be cutting at 6 a.m.
I got to go.
I got to go.
Right.
And they're coming around with your drink order. Uh-uh. Not me. Uh-uh. I got my A game tomorrow. So little, and that's just little sacrifices, but it means a lot. And it also means a lot to know you're at your best, that mental edge.
Yeah,
I don't
want to
walk in that operating room overtired and questioning my own skills that day. Uh-uh. I want the benefit of everything. I want to know that I looked at my cases the night before. I want to know that I watched your cataract coach videos the night before. I want to know that I had a good night's sleep. I'm coming in there. I'm ready to rock and roll.
I'm feeling great.
I'm feeling great. I got my A game, you know?
Oh, that's important. Yeah. And then you enjoy it. Like, the aura becomes your happy place.
Absolutely.
So I think the key there is really coming there with your A game. Coming to the operating room with the A game, giving your patients your best. You'll enjoy it more, and the patient will get better outcomes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it takes away the stress. You know you're bringing your A game.
Right.
You know you're bringing your A game. You don't have to have, as the surgeon, you know, you're going to go fly from here when you go back home. You want to know that the pilot the night before was out on the town?
You're right.
I
want him well rested. It begs a whole other question, to be honest. You know, we're at a crazy place now in the academic world where there's really a strong push to phase out merit and phase in, like, other criteria, which I think we got to be very cautious about and be very thoughtful about. Every situation, if that's the pilot for my plane, I want the best possible pilot.
Exactly.
If that's the surgeon for my surgery, I want the best surgeon possible. So I think we need to really go back to emphasizing ability and merit and skill and kind of that dedication that gets you to be so good.
Exactly. And you want the best person. You know, we have all it's perfectly fine diversity and sharing everything in life and the best of what life has to offer, but you want the best person for that,
of course,
for that,
for sure,
for that role, absolutely.
So it sounds like you had an amazing adventure over the last many decades in ophthalmology.
For sure.
So you're, I'm sure you're happy you did ophthalmology instead of doing obstetrics like your dad.
Oh my God, my mom, it would drive my mom crazy. Never home, always getting the calls in the middle of the night and go delivering a baby.
So you do it all over again for sure.
I would do it all over again. The only thing I might change, you know, to be honest, we get so eager and so hungry. You know, it's important even when you're young and hungry. Have a work-life balance.
That's the tough part.
I didn't learn that till later in life. I didn't learn that till later. You know, I wouldn't, you know, you can't get time back with your kids.
Mm-hmm.
You can always keep, you know, you can't, there's certain things that you don't want to trade for happiness. And I don't want to sound selfish. I love my career. I'm passionate about what I do. So passionate. And I always tried and I always thought I had a work-life balance. But it's very important. You'll be fresher. You'll be happier. And you don't want to miss out on moments of your own life and being there for your kids and doing things like that.
I think that's a great point. I think the younger generation of surgeons is very smart about that. The younger generation knows that there's got to be a balance. You just can't be a workaholic. In the old days, you're right. I did the same nonsense. I used to work 6 days a week. My Saturday morning clinic went till 4 p.m.
Yeah, yep.
I'd get more patients, I would take call for the hospital every day of the whole month. Just put me on call. I won't drink any alcohol. I will just be on call every day. And at the time, it sounded reasonable, but now looking back, it was probably not a great decision.
No, I agreed. And it's important, you know, I think you're right. Nowadays, the thinking is a little bit different. No disrespect to anybody at any generation. Mm-hmm. But for us, old school, or for me, old school,
right.
I'm still a young one, we were trained, and not trained, but we were also, the culture was to knock yourself out, just be totally all in and totally devoted. The younger generation today, this is a compliment, not a criticism, a compliment to them. They have a better sense of what they want out of life, and they'll be better off for it. You know, so much burnout and everything else, they're not going to burn out. They're not going to burn out because it's important as an investment in your future to have a well-balanced life and be at your best with what you love and what you do.
Wow, those are such great points.
Oh, I hope so.
No, it's like I'm about halfway through my ophthalmology journey. Sounds like you're coming towards the tail end of your ophthalmology journey, but I think it's just, it's part of our DNA now. We just love it so much, and it's been such an amazing field.
Absolutely.
Well, yes. I love chatting with you. I learned so much. And now everyone in our audience knows, if anyone says the riddle to you, what is a ticking time bomb in the eye? The answer is none of it. But in the old days, they used to say it was an IOL.
Yeah.
As wild as that sounds.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, Larry. Thank you so much again.
It's me thanking you. It was my honor. I appreciate it. I hope it had value. And to the audience out there, just stay tuned and keep up and everything we embrace today.
All righty. And remember, guys, we have a new podcast every single week. It's on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, even Alexa. Wherever you find your podcast, you can find the Cataract Coach podcast. Tell your friends about it, please. Hit the like button down below, and we will see you next week.